You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Brian Callen Show. I got Hunter Motz, Brian Callen, Hunter Motz Show. our guest is Tamim Ansari, and he has written a fantastic book. He's an Afghan-American author, public speaker. He is the author of West of Kabul, East of New York. And we are here to talk about his latest book called Destiny Interrupted.
No, Destiny Disrupted.
Destiny Disrupted.
But that's actually his previous book, Brian.
Yeah. Is it?
Yeah. So.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Well, good. So Destiny Disrupted. You know,
history of the world through Islamic eyes.
Right, but now we're presumably talking about games without rules. The often interrupted history of Afghanistan.
Yeah, we'd love to talk about both, and if we could, I mean, I think to start off with Destiny Disrupted and then to move into the history of Afghanistan, is that possible?
Sure, whatever you guys want.
Yeah, and it just bears mentioning that you are Afghani, which really means, and we were talking about this, you are from a lot of different parts of Afghanistan. You have Hazara, Tajik, and are you also Pashtun?
No, I don't think I have any Pashtun in me, although I was surprised to discover when I went back, right after 9/11, that part of my ancestral village is Pashtun or Pashto-speaking anyhow.
Right. Well, one of the things that I think is important about the book and important about your perspective is that, and you talk about this, is we have been indoctrinated into a very Western-centric, Eurocentric, even Christian sort of notion of what history is about.
Yeah.
And really, the Islamic contribution is a footnote. It's not the story of Islam and Islam's contribution. The story of that religion and its people has not really been told or heard so much in at least this country, maybe more so in Europe. But I think you've done a good job in trying to, you know, give voice to that.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
I thought the opening of Destiny Disrupted is so powerful as well, because you're talking about the experience of trying to write textbooks for, you know, American students.
Yeah, and I was describing that my sense of history, because I was born and raised in Afghanistan and learned my first history in Afghan schools there, Islam was a pretty big event in history. But when I was speaking with my consultants and other experts on how many chapters to devote to one thing or another, eventually the Islam chapter got reduced to, you know, 1/30th of the book, one chapter out of 30, and it pretty much dealt with what happened in the 7th, 8th century, you know, when Islam was born. But after that, it kind of ceased to exist. There wasn't any Islam after that.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I love, one of the things I think is very important is that you really talk a great deal about how our notion of these two camps, Islam, in a lot of people's eyes, you know, 9/11 is responsible for a lot of this, perhaps. But the idea that we broke into two camps, the idea that, you know, Western civilization is about reason and it's about women's rights and freedom and democracy, and the Islamic world is really more about puritanical religion and bags over a woman's head all that kind of stuff, as opposed to thinking, well, these people were actually more concerned with vice and more interested in discipline and had their own doubts about religion. So these two camps are not talking to each other. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, what I was saying is it's not we believe something and they believe the opposite. It's rather that we have our own center, and then everything is arranged around that center. And they have a center, and everything is arranged around that center. If you were born and looking at the world from someplace between, let's say, Istanbul and the Indus River, that's pretty much the heartland of Islam. From there, the history of the world has a certain appearance, and up until about 200 years ago, Western European culture, 200, 300 years ago, that was on the peripheries. And from the point of view of the Islamic world, things were proceeding in a certain direction and would ultimately be perfected. And it strikes me that, you know, when you're living in this world, we also feel that way. We feel that, values like democracy, parliamentary or popular electoral democracy, the various systems and the values we have, these are finally, we've achieved finally the truth, and all the world will eventually be here. So I think those are two world views. Now, you know, you said earlier these two camps and so on. I will remind you that until, you know, into the 70s, into the 80s, there was no sense of the world being divided into these two camps.
It was, you know, Soviet, it was communist thought, and capitalist. Yeah, Soviet
and
American.
Yeah, we thought it was
yeah.
communism and capitalism.
Yep.
And in 1980, I went traveling in the 1979-80s, like right after the hostages were taken in Iran, which was kind of the first shot of this thing that's happening now. When I went traveling there in the Muslim world in 1980, I was surprised to discover that on the streets, you know, the common people, they were starting to say something which later we hear a lot, which is, oh, communism and capitalism are the same thing. That's the West. The real division in the world is between the West and Islam. And so, you know, nobody was hearing that then, but on the street, that was what everybody was talking about.
Hmm.
You know, but the clash between Christianity and Islam goes back, and even before this, but really had its crescendo with the fall of Constantinople, didn't it? I mean, isn't that what
the Crusades or even before that?
Right,
you know?
But I'm saying for the Christian mind, the idea that, you know, there was, oh, that rift was probably never really been healed, the idea that, well, this is what the sound of a civilization is, these huge cannons breaking into these walls that have stood for 1,000 years, and that the whole population sold into slavery by these Turks and whatever it might be. There's this sort of was the beginning of, there was always antagonism, but it feels like that was a very important part of history.
That was a crucial moment. But it's interesting to note that the opposite thing was happening at the other end of the Islamic world. Right about the same time that Constantinople was falling to the Turks, in Spain, the Reconquista was happening,
mm-hmm.
and they took Granada and they drove the last Muslims out of Spain, which had been, you know, one of the heartlands of the Muslim Empire. Cordoba was one of the largest cities in the world at one time. So they drove the last of those guys out, and there was a triumphalist resurgence of Christian culture at that end of the world, where in the eastern end of the same world, Constantinople fell to the Turks. So the balance was shifting in both directions, both ways at the same time, pretty much. But then, you know, on the western end, there was a takeoff. Columbus sailed west and discovered America, and the silver came in. It was right around that time that the scientific revolution was in progress in Europe, and the so-called Age of Exploration began. You know, this is another one of
sure.
those terminologies that would
would
be different in the two places. The Age of Exploration was really, you know, an age of colonization, the beginning of that. And so I would say that, you know, the bases for the clash that we see in the world now began in this era of expansive Western, Western expansion across the globe. And I think I make the point in my book that throughout the Muslim world in that period, there wasn't a sense that there was a clash and the West was conquering these Muslim countries. For the most part, you know, they came in as commercial interests. Soon they became somehow dominant in those cultures, and soon they were the controllers of rulers who were still native rulers. You know, it wasn't that there was a king of India. There was still, for a while anyhow, there was still, you know, the the Mughals were there, and then the Rajas, and in Iran, they still had the Shah of Iran, and he was controlled by British imperial colonial interests, and so, you know, for the Muslims at that point, the question came up, you know, how come we haven't been conquered? How come we're so weak?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right?
And then the answer that presented itself in many places was, well, we're weak because, you know, some did say we're weak because we have not adopted the science and the values of the West, and others proposed that Muslims are weak because they have stopped being the true Muslims of the olden days.
Mm-hmm.
So in the Islamic world, that came up to be a clash between two, you know, factions, two schools of thought, two power groups.
And so
one became obsessed with purity, i.e. the Wahhabi Muslims versus the...
Obsessed with purity and obsessed with...
piety.
and also with an idea that there was something mystically forceful in living according to the exact prescriptions and proscriptions that were derived from the sayings of Prophet Muhammad and from the Quran, so that there is almost a sense of a clockwork way to behave. And if everybody would only do that, then you know, there would be prosperity, power, harmony, and the perfect community would come to be on earth.
And that's something that you really find throughout world history is that, you know, when this outside force comes and it's obviously powerful, part of the community says, oh, we need to be more like the outsiders, and the other part of the community says we need to be more us. I mean, that's really what happened in China with the Boxer Rebellion. You know, there's this idea that, oh, if we are truly Chinese, if we are purely Chinese, then, you know, we will win.
Yeah, that's right. And it's tapping into a sense of the power and history of Chinese culture. It's been in periods very powerful. So, you know,
Bucking tradition is always going to be very difficult, especially when you can point to an entire, you know, when your whole culture is based on that. You tend, people who get scared tend to hold on to that and try to become more what they are.
Yeah.
The issue, though, is actually, and I wanted to ask you, if you read the Quran is really a blueprint for how to run your entire society. I mean, the Quran teaches you about the laws behind marriage, behind banking, behind everything. And it was in, and correct me if I'm wrong about that, but it's for the most part, it's very much a blueprint for how to live your life to the nth degree.
And how to structure an entire society.
Exactly. Is that true, Professor?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It is that, but the Quran actually has parts that came into the world in the early parts of Prophet Muhammad's career. And those verses are very sort of incantatory. They're not very
Is that what they call the Sunnah?
No, it's just parts of the Quran. You know,
okay.
It's like if they're not arranged in such a chronological order that you'd be able to see. But the Quran that was spoken by Prophet Muhammad when he was still in Mecca is really sort of mystical and talks about the God created the mountains and the this and that. You know, and if you live by his rules, you will go to heaven, and hell is an awful place. But when he went to Medina, then Prophet Muhammad was the actual secular, as I would say, secular head of a community. And so people would come up with practical day-to-day problems. They'd say, what should I do about this? What should I do about that? And at that point, then verses came down in the Quran that were specific, you know, rules and regulations
that he supposedly wrote. I mean, there's only one author of the Quran, and it was Muhammad. The angel Gabriel, I guess, spoke to him. That's the legend, right?
Right, and the belief in Islam is that the Quran was not written by Muhammad. It just came through.
It was written by God.
It was written by God.
Yes,
yeah.
But so he was the last person to talk to God. Even though they believe that Moses probably talked to God, they do. The Quran does talk about Jesus being a great prophet, just not the Son of God, etc.
Not the Son of God, but a prophet. Therefore, God spoke through him.
Okay, so God spoke.
He was a messenger.
Okay.
And But you know, the legalistic blueprint of society that you just mentioned is not cannot be derived from the Quran.
Okay,
there's some stuff there, but it doesn't. It's not a complete blueprint. Very incomplete, actually. So that's why, in Muslim civilization, one of the really big events of it's like the enterprise of Muslim history has been to complete that blueprint, to fill it in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been derived from, well, what did so the Quran doesn't say, but what did Muhammad himself say? And did anything like this come up in his time? How did he decide about those? And so, you know, there's this really architectonic structure as you have put it, a blueprint of society and individual conduct that had developed over the 300-400 years after, the time of Muhammad, and that's what they call the Sharia.
Oh, that's the Sharia. Okay,
yeah.
That's Islamic law.
Because Islamic law.
Because one of the things you hear a lot is that you'll hear people say Islam is not compatible with democracy. And when this British MP, and I can't remember his name, but he gave several speeches on Afghanistan that I listened to, and he traveled extensively through Afghanistan. And one of the things he said is, look, he said, and just taking Afghanistan as an example, because he was very critical of the British and American plan for Afghanistan and how we went about.
Was there a plan?
Yeah, there wasn't. but that's a good point. But he said, I have been to the most remote villages in Afghanistan. I've never met anyone who didn't want some say in who governs them.
Yeah.
And that's a human. That's sort of a human need, isn't it? It's a human impulse. We all want our own sovereignty. We all want a say on who governs us.
But you know, now I think let's move over to Afghanistan in particular. In a way, my latest book is kind of a case study of the thing I'm saying in the previous book. Afghanistan is a case study of a place that had its own system for. For people living together. And earlier you said, oh, it's been a bunch of tribes. Well, it is, but let's not overstate the idea that the tribes were always fighting. You know, there is a somewhat recognizable culture that has permeated Afghanistan throughout these centuries. And it's one in which the relationships among people, because it's tribal, because, you know, the political units have been relatively small, the relationships among people have been very informal and personal, so that, the actual rulers of everyday life usually have been people that you know, and usually they've been people you're sort of related to, you know?
Yeah.
Because...
Well, you do a great job of describing we voted. What do you mean? Well, we marked some paper.
Yeah.
Well, obviously we're gonna vote. I mean, the guy who rules is the guy who lives in that big house over there who gives candy to children and comes over. I mean, that's what makes sense.
Yeah. Incidentally, that guy is now running for president of Afghanistan, and there's some talk that he might win.
Oh, wow. There you go.
which would be a sorry state of affairs. But in any case, you know, what I want to say is that when we went into Afghanistan, we had the enthusiasm for introducing democracy to this culture. And our idea of democracy was a certain apparatus, you know, a parliament, a constitution,
mm-hmm.
and then, ministries of this and that. And so we kind of dropped this apparatus right down on top of the culture.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I have observed when I've been there, and what I would also assume from what I know, is that there is a political system operating in Afghanistan that has nothing to do with that, in a sense. You know, there's a way in which people recognize leaders, group behind their leaders, organize their actions, and it's going on simultaneously with this other thing that's happening, which is the parliament, the elections, the democracy, the ministries of this and that, and I feel that in Afghan culture today, what are you going to do about that? It's here. It's been brought here by this, overwhelming power, and money is coming into the society, billions of dollars, and they're all funneling through this apparatus. So if you want some of that money, you better get close to that apparatus. So people do run for election. They do, try to get into the ministries and get control of contracts to develop the mines or build schools or something, because that's where the money is. And if, you know, it's a society that the economy has been destroyed, so you want to get close to whatever money's there. But the old way of operating means that it's networks of extended families, it's clans, it's tribes, it's who you know, and all of that is operating. And when those two systems mix, when we look at it, what we see is corruption. Because when a person gets into a ministry and has a good position there, of course they're going to help their family.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
What kind of a person would they be if they just started helping strangers? You know.
Yeah, you're right.
That's so funny. I mean, that's so much of as well in both, you know, Game Without Rules and Destiny Disrupted. Just the sense that there really are these two worldviews, and that, you know, I thought what you said earlier was very interesting about the idea that so much of what Western society is that we figured things out, and now if just everybody else would just get on board, you know, like accept that democracy, and that's very much also...
I suffer from that.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to admit, I find myself having to, we were talking about this. You know, you talk to people and you learn. This podcast has been so fun. I get to talk to people like you who I wouldn't get to talk to otherwise. And one of the things, it's always a learning experience. You always are. I come to the table thinking I know something, and then of course I don't. And you're a good example of this, just talking about Afghanistan. But it's. I have been indoctrinated, even though I grew up all over the world. I've been indoctrinated to believe that, and I do believe that democracy, in the American sense of the word, and the Constitution is the truth and the way to go. But I didn't grow up outside of Kandahar in a small tribal village, and that stuff may not work. What really works is water rights, and I need to make sure my sheep can eat, and et cetera, because the winter's coming, and there are other more practical matters. I need to be able to know that I can trade with my neighbor. Those are the things that actually make a bigger difference.
Yeah, you know, I'll just take a moment to say I also completely buy into the Constitution, the American you know, the political democracy in America is, in fact, what I also embrace. But I grew up in Afghanistan in another system. When I was a kid, there was hardly any trace of America in that culture. I was that trace because, you know, my mother
you were
the first American woman to marry an Afghan and go live in that country. So, you know, me and my sister, we were the only Afghan Americans for a while there.
Wow.
You know, then there were a few more, but basically we really, from the start, were these people with a foot in either culture.
And your father had a long lineage, a distinguished lineage
Afghanistan. I come from a family that has a certain lineage in Afghanistan, and that lineage is entirely based on religious and cultural credentials. We're not people who have military or political importance, but we have many supposed saints and poets in the in the family tree.
Artists. the first people to be imprisoned when the military comes to power, because your ideas are dangerous.
Well, no, not in Afghanistan, because, you know, it's a Muslim culture, so having religious credentials does give you a certain kind of untouchable status. So we had that. And I would also say that my family was, you know, being entrenched in the doctrines of Islam, more the Sufi side of things, but still in that area, we were a religious family. So therefore, we were sort of a conservative religious family. Mm. Therefore, we were privileged in terms of our closeness to the court. Therefore, my father and, you know, my uncles were among the first to be sent abroad to study at universities. Therefore, we became the liberal.
Wow.
We became the most liberal segment of Afghan society.
Education has a way of doing that.
Education, yeah. But I was just going to say that, you know, when I grew up, and I grew up entirely in this world that was all tribal, and, you know, we were so much in the... our contacts were within the family, and it was family-to-family contact. And there was a lot of warmth and something really good about that society. But it partly depended on the fact that it was purely whatever it was. It was all that society. There wasn't a mixture of different things. And now I go back to Afghanistan, and one of the things that's happened, partly as a result of all the wars, but really to a large extent in the last 10 years, our influence has been that we have said, we've brought a sort of a free market idea into Afghanistan, and an ideology of it's every man, woman, and child against every other man, woman, and child, and let the best of them succeed. Mm. And so what has eroded there, just even since 2002, when I went back after all the destruction and found the culture sort of unchanged, the spiritual aspect of that culture. Now I go back last year, and I find that it's atomized. It's like mm-hmm. everybody's hungrily on the make.
Wow. Because it's very hard to change a culture. Cultures are so incredibly resilient. So that's but I guess the Soviets and their own civil war and then the American war will ultimately break the back of a
and
culture.
And money. I mean, I think that's what you're talking about in terms of there are those billions of dollars that flood into the economy, and they really, totally change what the incentive schemes are for people.
Yeah. I think it's two things. The last thing was the money, and then the prior thing was the violence, first with the Soviets, then with the Civil War, that really decimated all the kind of the structures of family and tribe. Mm-hmm. When you think about the Soviets bombing the country, and the rural families all became refugees in Pakistan and Iran, but then the men went back into the country and left the women and children on the outside. That was a certain way in which the family structures were really severed.
Yeah.
Well, and that's, I think, one of the things. I mean, obviously, we're all big fans of, Western-style democracy and free market capitalism and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But the thing is to realize that, we had to go through an incredibly long process to reach that. And I think one of the things that Americans sort of naively assume is there was this evil king, and then the next day we were a democracy. And they don't realize that, the groundwork for that had been laid 100 years before with the Glorious Revolution when, suddenly you have, the law is above the king.
Yeah.
And, I mean, my parents live in Libya, and, that rule of law concept does not exist. I mean, it really doesn't.
No, it takes a long time to win. That idea takes a long time to win the day.
Yeah, I think the rule of law is a really huge thing, and that when you live in an American society, you take it for granted.
Mm-hmm.
You assume that that's just sort of the default state of society, and if you remove, government structures and certain kinds of understandings, that will still be there. I think that we mistakenly suppose that elections are what democracy is. But I think elections are the kind of the last step in democracy. There's all this other stuff. There's, there's the rule of law. There is, I can go into any library. People can, discuss whatever. I can spout any nonsense that comes into my head as I'm doing right now.
Yeah. But wasn't Kabul like that? Wasn't Kabul a trading post? Wasn't that part of the end of the Silk Road?
Every opinion was there. Yes, and there was a very strict kind of separation between what was inside the family and the compounds and the bazaar, the outside, the public world. So in the public world, people had some circumspection about what they said, particularly if it had to do with the royal family, the king, the political power.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be careful about those things because those guys had had the power of life and death. But inside the family, then it was just the power. The only thing that squelched you was the power of social disapproval, which was not nothing. That's a big controlling element in Afghan culture. Here, I would say social disapproval is not a very powerful force. There's
If anything, it's a galvanizing force.
I mean,
Americans, you know, when society is like, what you're doing is wrong, they're like, that's right, I'm bucking the trend.
That's right.
You know, I'm an innovator.
Social disapproval is almost a badge of merit.
Absolutely.
When I went to Afghanistan, I did a USO tour, and one of the things I noticed is flying over the country, no trees. There was no trees, there was no greenery, because the Soviets did their best to literally strip that country of all its vegetation as well. Is that true?
Well, they did. They didn't exactly go to strip the vegetation. They just went to depopulate the countryside, because the countryside is where... You know, in other guerrilla situations, the guerrillas go to the next country over, and they have their safe bases there.
Yeah.
But in Afghanistan, the guerrillas went to their own villages, and they had their safe bases there.
So they would just bomb the villages and kill everybody.
So they decided to bomb the villages and just drive them all out, and they did that. Well, in doing that, they also, destroyed some of the greenery, so to speak, the fields and so on.
Yeah, nice guys, the Soviets. Real nice guys.
They were awful.
Yeah.
And then, after all of that happened, there was a certain, it's hard to document, but some people say there was a concerted effort by Pakistan to get rid of Afghanistan's fruit trees, because that was an economic competition. The Pakistanis have the same things. And that one of the ways that they did that is they, in a country that was starving, they said, "We'll buy your wood, but only whole trees. You have to, bring them with the roots attached."
Wow,
God, that's so awful. It's so awful to think, and the Soviets have never paid a price for what they did to the Afghanis. My question is this: we know how badly they've suffered. To what extent? I always heard that the Afghanis were an incredibly warlike people, that they were always fighting among each other, that they were never a conquerable country because they weren't a conquerable country. We go through this, and I know you were talking about how it does have culture and things, but to what extent, and it's a controversial question, especially for an Afghani, but to what extent do the Afghanis bear responsibility for the fact that their country is such a mess?
To what extent are they responsible, or are you saying to what extent do they take responsibility?
To what extent are they responsible? If in fact I am right in saying that the Afghanis have always been a very warlike country, and in fact, if you hear you hear these stories before the Soviets came in that they were very brutal to not only competing tribes, and for example, you're part Hazara. I've heard horror stories about, the atrocities committed against the Hazara because they were descendants of the Buddhists or the Asians and things. And you hear these terrible stories. You didn't want to be held captive by Afghanis because you were going to be in some big trouble, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of this is folklore and stuff. But to what extent is...
I think there's two sides to that coin.
Okay.
One side is that most of the time, most Afghans were living in peace with most other Afghans. There was a period of warfare in which that one king who decided to conquer his own country so as to build a nation out of a fragmented landscape of disparate tribes, he went about the conquest of his own country, and that was the period in which the Hazaras were conquered, and it was brutal for them. And that brutality happened, and it was in the 1890s. And once he died, he, for better or for worse, he left a country that was united and governable. And there was a coup d'etat and a bit of a revolution and stuff that we thought was such a dramatic thing when I was growing up. And I look back, and, the king was ousted in 1929, and order was restored by end of 1930. So we're talking about less than two-year period of turmoil. Other than that, from about 1900 to about 1975, 76, right in there, that country was at peace.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. Then once, but the other side of the coin is that Afghanistan has such a tendency to fall apart, to fragment. And what I'm, the point I'm mainly trying to make, or one of them, in Games Without Rules, is that Afghans are not, it's not so much that they're hard to conquer, it's that they're hard to govern. You know, it's hard to construct a nationwide structure that will, that they'll all buy into, and you can have a united nation. They just fall apart into tribes, you know, individuals. And
so the minute there's trouble, they go back to their tribe, basically.
Right. The minute there's trouble, they coalesce into ever smaller groups. So now, you know, because of that, once you have the climate of violence, it was impossible to restore some kind of order after the communists left, and the country had fallen apart into hundreds upon hundreds of little armies. You know, so there was no way for those armies to sit down at a conference table and
yeah, it was just groups of bandits trying to get theirs. I mean,
yeah, everybody. Everybody was down to surviving with their, you know, one guy who was good with a gun and the 10 guys who followed him.
Yeah.
So, you know, so now, however, I feel like there is also an absence on the part of at least Afghans outside the country of taking responsibility for what's happened in Afghanistan and for what will happen. Because, you know, now it's really up to Afghans. And Afghans have to get together and figure it out. And I don't know, I'm sure that America can't help now. I'm pretty certain about that.
I have a feeling, too. We've given it 11 years.
Yeah,
and I don't think that the influence of America is really moving in a productive direction anymore, nor could it.
You're such a cynic. You can't give it another 10 years? This is the year.
No, I feel like when America leaves, if it does, America is not actually leaving. I should mention that, you know.
What do you mean by that?
Well, America is retreating to the garrison strategy. So they have built some big bases in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
They're city-sized bases.
I've been to Bagram. It's a city. It's literally a city.
Yeah, it's a city, and there's another one in the north, and I think the Kandahar one, they've told me. I haven't been
huge.
There.
Huge. I've been there, too. It's giant. Yeah.
So they have these big bases, and they're not in the process of getting out of those, but they're in the process of not having, a small contingents of troops all over the country in direct interface with Afghans. So to that extent, they're coming out. If, in fact, their military power does withdraw from the bulk of the country, Afghans will be faced with figuring it out amongst each other. And I think it's completely imponderable what will happen. But when it does happen, what will come out of that will be an Afghan political structure that, you know, that answers to Afghans.
I would imagine they're too exhausted to fight again, I hope.
I would wish that, but I don't think that...
that's the case.
Unfortunately, I don't think that's the case.
It's certainly not borne out by history,
Even more fighting, then.
Yeah.
Well, this really goes back to something that you were saying earlier about how there's, you know, already an Afghan, you know, system in place for dealing with things. And it reminds me of something that Francis Fukuyama said, which is, he said that family relationships are the enemy of the state. Like, that is the state's mortal enemy, because people end up having loyalties to second cousins, third cousins, and those obligations become more important than their obligations to the law. So I wonder to what extent, because, I mean, you certainly see this in Libya. Does the family need to be destroyed or reduced down to that sort of Western nuclear family before you can have Western-style democracy?
You raise a very interesting question, because I do think that the breakdown of large family structures down to nuclear family units is somehow integrally connected with the formation of democratic capitalist industrial society. It's true that nuclear family units can be moved around. You know, they're mobile. if you have a very large family structure, like I do, for example, You know, when I went to D.C. A while back, that's where most of my refugee family members live. And they was like, oh, well, we'll have a barbecue, and we're not going to invite everybody, just the inner circle. And so that was 100 people.
God, weddings must be a nightmare.
That was a family dinner.
Yeah, you got to have a lot of money to get married.
Right, and then, you know, and those are only the ones here, but we are still connected to everybody in Afghanistan, and there's a whole village there that's us guys. And I will just report for myself that is like a little state in the sense that when I get close to it, it has a gravitational pull and I go into orbit, you know. It's like, and when I come out of there, I feel like I'm an individual again,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I can operate and I can move and I can make decisions for myself. But when I'm inside the gravitational orbit of the family, you know, I can operate, but only, you know, in that field.
Exactly. So there's that's the point, is that those large family structures act as competing states.
Yeah.
And there can only really be one state.
Yeah. You know, the other thing is the state that we have kind of constructed is rationalized so that this ties in with the rule of law. You know, it's like the laws have an independence from who's executing them or constructing them. They exist on their own. And the government, the roles that are the government, exist on their own. Different people fill them, but it's always that government. You know, it's like we elect the president, now he has all those powers. I forget where I'm going with that.
No, I hear you. I mean,
yeah, it's based. It's not based on, oh, my aunt said this and my aunt did this for me, so therefore the rule doesn't necessarily apply. Like the rule always applies.
The rule always applies, and you know, part of the reason why I am favorably disposed towards political democracy as we know it here, is that finally, once everybody in a country buys into that. Then there is a uniform common structure that different ethnicities can all take part in it, different, you know, all the diverse factions and elements in a country can all take part in that. But in a country where that's weak and the family and the tribe and then the ethnic group are strong, if you have a political party, it'll always be the political party of an ethnic group,
mm-hmm.
or of a family, mm-hmm. you know, or of some individual powerful leader, and they won't represent any idea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
they will only represent power,
and power for that group.
Yeah, power for that group.
So you're not. I was going to ask you before if you were optimistic about Afghanistan, and then I want to ask you whether or not you're optimistic about the Islamic world's place in this ever-changing, westernized, dominated world. Where is it? What is the story for the next 10 years for you, do you think?
Well, I think the story for Afghanistan is connected with the story for the world. You know, my optimism is not high for the next 2 years. that's where I'm nervous.
I'll be with you.
But one thing that I did notice and that is so amazingly happening in Afghanistan is that the isolation of that country is just dissipating at an incredibly rapid rate. Technology is just permeating the place.
Satellite, you know, dishes and internet and things like that.
The internet is all over. Cell phones are everywhere, you know. There are things like solar power has spread through the country so that isolated places that, you know, that otherwise would not know about anything have TV, you know, powered by solar power,
mm-hmm.
with satellite dishes, and they can get the stations from Kabul, and the stations from Kabul are so diverse and so vigorous. They have a huge, vigorous media. So I think it's interesting to see, you know, and I always think technology is going to have effects that trump political efforts.
Yeah, commerce and technology are hard to compete with and hard to fight. They do
That's
change
right.
hearts
they're
and
minds. They're like water on rock, you know,
yeah.
they wear it away.
Yeah.
So Afghanistan willy-nilly is joining the world.
Wow.
Now.
But then we have this problem called the Taliban. What is, I know a Talib means student, but what in the world is going on with these guys? What is Pakistan doing? What do they want, for Christ's sake? What do they want other than the fact they want to destroy everything? It drives me up a wall. I mean, how many guys have to, how many Talib have to be killed before... You know, I guess the American idea is let's build hospitals and schools and kill anybody trying to bomb those things. And I understand that mentality because I don't know what else I would do, because these guys are just, for lack of a better word, real a-holes. I mean, you know, right? I mean, come on. I mean, geez, brutal.
Well, to my mind, the Taliban, one definition I could give is that they are the reactionary end of what exists in Afghan culture.
Yeah.
So they're not like a a group with an ideology. They are just, you know, if you consider in any society, the most crazed reactionary elements, those are the Taliban.
Yeah. Young, crazy men with nothing else to make themselves feel significant.
And right, they're not necessarily young, you know, there's older crazy men.
Yep.
In Afghanistan, but then it melts into two other problems. One is that the border has dissolved between Afghanistan and Pakistan, so there's this incipient, you know, there's sort of like this barely bubbling sense of a different country in there.
Mm-hmm.
And that different country is very rural. It's very, when you talk about Afghans being independent and nobody can intrude on their lives, that's most the case in that area.
You're talking about Waziristan, that area?
Waziristan, Konar, and also, you know, down in the southwestern desert, Helmand and stuff.
That's always been a lawless area, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's always been lawless, and it's always been dominated by... you know, this tribalism, personal network thing that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So there's that country that isn't really part of Afghanistan. That straddles that fake border.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the element of Pakistan, which has ambitions as a state. It's also kind of a suspect state as states go, because it's also got factions and forces that are centripetal. But some of the Talibanism is the efforts of elements in Pakistan to enlarge their power across the border into Afghanistan. And that's a thing that is not soon going to be solved. I remember once when I was in... you know, I went to Afghanistan in 2002. There were some the first traces of elections happening there. And I talked to some guy who was running, and he said, you know, whenever Afghanistan is powerful, we try to go into Pakistan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And whenever Pakistan is powerful and we're weak, they try to come into our country. So that's just like...
Well, it's in Afghanistan's interest to keep Afghanistan less than stable.
Yeah, that's right. And then, of course, Iran has also got some interest in that regard.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and the interesting thing is, you're talking about all of this sort of stuff, is that, you know, those fundamentalists, the Taliban and all that sort of stuff, we conflate that. We think that, oh, the cause of that is Islam. But it's really that tribalism and that lawlessness that you're talking about, which you'll find the same thing in Papua New Guinea. You'll find the same thing all over the world. And I think that's so much of what the disservice is that has been done. Is that, you know, I mean, in Libya, for example, there are 7 million Libyans, 7,000 of them are Salafis.
Yeah.
But there's this idea that that's the majority of the society, and that's not the majority of the society. It's just that when you're angry in a country that doesn't have rule of law, you express it by blowing people up.
Yeah,
that's right. That's the case. Then there's this other factor that I just want to raise, which is that in that lawless area, it's not actually lawless. It's games without rules. You know, there are rules that that are never written or stated.
Yeah, it's decided by the jirga, the tribal councils and Sharia and all that stuff.
Well,
right?
And you know, prestige, and you know, everybody who lives there knows who has the power, but they don't have an official position and so on. Well, throughout that area, everybody who has power will not have power if it is absorbed into the state. There will be different powers. So everybody that's in there has an incentive to keep the state out, keep out the foreigners, and keep things the way they are. There are people who lack power there that are oppressed by them, and that's most starkly the case with women who live in that part of the world. They're completely under the power of the men who run their families, but they can't have any power. Because these guys, you know, what you're calling the Taliban, they control the ground, you know.
They control the ground, yeah.
Yeah, so we have power that can fly over and kill them, but we can't really help the women that are under their power.
It feels like such a massive problem, especially when you bring Pakistan and Iran in.
Yeah.
Two powerful countries in that region. I guess the only thing you hope for is that Pakistan and Pakistan and Iran cancel one another out, but I don't think that's going to happen.
No, that's not going to happen.
No, and so then we're back to the same waxing and waning, and the people, and this war is played out in the backs of the children, the women, and the innocents of Afghanistan.
Yeah.
It's a true tragedy. It really is, you know.
It is a tragedy, yeah.
One of the things that you know, you go there, and just having spent so much time in the world as I have, living there, really living there in the Middle East, and even spending time in Afghanistan, you know, what people don't really want to believe, and it's true, is that everybody suffers exactly the way you do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Everybody wants the same thing out of their life. They're not even that religious. They just want a better life for their children. They just want some security. They just want to know when their head hits the pillow, nobody's going to be knocking on that door and taking them for a walk.
Yeah.
Those are the basic human things that we all long for. And some, unfortunately, Afghanistan, it's been a very long time since anybody in that country, unless you've got a lot of guns and a lot of men around you. It's been a long time since anybody's had any say over their own person, much less their own government.
Yeah, that's correct. You know, and the one other thing I would say is that it's hard to talk about Afghanistan and give a picture of what's going on there without conveying some sense that, oh, that land is peculiar and exotic.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, you know, my own experience going there, and you can see that I'm talking to you, and I'm a normal guy here.
Yeah.
And when I go over there, I talk to them, and I'm a normal guy, and they're normal folks too. There's nothing exotic about anyone.
Nope, there sure isn't. There sure isn't. Not when you get up close and personal. Guess what? They laugh at the same things and they cry at the same things.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just the curse of the world is this idea that they're different. They're us versus them, and somehow they see they are different than we are. I don't think so.
Well, yeah.
And that's one of the things that I most loved what you did so well in the intro of Destiny Disrupted and throughout the book is that the decision to tell the Islamic version of history not as an objective history but as a story, because that's so much of how we experience our own things, and there's so much, I mean, that's the point. It's all felt so emotionally.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you for seeing that.
Yeah. Well, sir, I really thank you so much for joining us and for you know, it's really we really very much appreciate somebody like you coming and taking the time and talking to us, because it's always a learning lesson. And the book that we were talking about is Destiny Disrupted, A History of the World Through Islamic Eyes. Hunter, why don't you talk about the other books?
And then also Games Without Rules, The Oft-Interrupted History of Afghanistan, which, I mean, is amazing. I mean, also just some of the stories that are in there are so fantastic. I mean, the story about, you know, the British garrison and their retreat from Afghanistan, and one person survived.
Yeah, that's
a true story, isn't it? Where they allowed one person to live and go back and tell the British
Her Majesty
what they're dealing with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I have an Afghan friend here who is a small-time businessman, and he runs a food cart someplace. And he told me that, you know, in the 50s, he was doing a little business in Afghanistan, and he ran into a British guy. And at that time, there was hardly any British, you know, guys. Just there were no tourists. So this guy was wandering around, and he said, "Who are you?" And the guy said he was the grandson of that one survivor.
Oh,
grandson,
my God.
A great-grandson.
Wow.
Of that one survivor. And so my friend and this guy cooked up a business together, which had something to do with, you know, buying vehicles in London, driving them to Afghanistan with tourists, selling them. I forget what it was, but this my Afghan friend and the great-grandson of Dr. Bryden went into business together.
Wow.
So funny.
That's I love it.
Yeah.
Well, we very much appreciate you joining us here. It was a real learning experience and great to get your perspective on this crazy world, man. I just wish the best, you know.
All right.
And I think you're doing your best to try to make a difference.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. It's been a pleasure, guys.
And they really are. I mean, they are such great books. I mean, they're such fun reads.
Yeah,
it's so fascinating.
Well, Destiny Disrupted was awesome.
Yeah.
Now, by the way, do you live in San Francisco?
I do.
Well, I'm going to be in San Francisco February 27th, 28th, and March 1st at the Punchline doing comedy.
Oh, really?
So I want you to take my email. Hunter will send you my email and my phone number.
Okay.
You bring anybody you want, your family. I don't bring that 100 people if you want. We'll probably sell out quickly, but I'll get your inner circle in, and you'll have VIP treatment, my friend. So I would love you to come to a show, please, on my dime.
All right. Well, I'd love to. My inner circle now is just me and my wife.
So. That's it, baby. I can
You'll
find,
be happy to know.
I will find good seats for you.
All right.
I will make you laugh. It won't be very. It'll be rather Eurocentric, probably. It won't be. I won't have a whole lot of Islamic jokes, but
Well, that's probably a good thing.
It's probably a good thing.
It has been noticed.
Indeed. So please give me a call or email me if you want to come to the show. I'll remind you when it gets closer to the date as well.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, sir.
And you, Hunter.
Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Take care.
Bye.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.